counting on Netanyahu to achieve something at any point, like what happened with this ridiculous operation in releasing the two hostages, which seems to be it's being questioned really by the serious Israeli newspapers, where they are saying there is a lot of exaggeration in presenting this release. And the Americans apparently still really signing the blank check for Netanyahu just to carry out this genocidal actions all the time. So I don't see in any time, like any near time, any kind of positive response from Netanyahu.
And Amar, how do you square what we just heard and what you said earlier with the U.S. president calling Netanyahu an recently and calling what's happening in the Gaza Strip as over the top? Yet, yes, of course, we see the huge package of aid for Israel at the same time. But what is your reading into this whole thing?
Well, I mean, when it comes to Joe Biden, I would seriously question his mental faculties at the moment. But look, I mean, I think that we see very often Western politicians, particularly those in the United States, may in private have serious questions about what Israel is doing. They may in private very much oppose what Israel is doing. But ultimately, we're in a position now where I think the tail wags the dog. Mm. You know, people talk about Israel as being an extension of the United States. Well, actually, if you look at the amount of lobbying power that Israel has managed to influence within the United States, I think it's now really the other way around. Israel is dictating U.S. international policy. And so it doesn't really matter what they may privately think. Ultimately, they are signed up to a political system in which they are obligated, really, to support Israel. So I think that's really why we see these contradictions.
Correct. Gentlemen, stay with me. We're going to bring in what the UN chief has been saying, and then we'll get back to you shortly. Well, Antonio Guterres says an Israeli military offensive in Gaza, the southern city where some more than 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge, will have devastating consequences. He has told reporters that Tel Aviv has imposed restrictions that are limiting the distribution of desperately needed humanitarian aid. He said the current mechanisms for protecting humanitarian workers distributing aid in Gaza are not effective. Here's more in his own words.
I know that Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't take your phone calls. You have not been able to speak to him despite your best efforts. We know that he is preparing potentially for a ground invasion to Rafah. If you could speak to Prime Minister Netanyahu today, what would be your message?
Well, I am particularly worried with the deteriorating conditions and security for humanitarian aid delivery in Gaza. There is a breakdown in public order. At the same time, we have restrictions imposed by Israel that are not improving and limit humanitarian distribution. On the other hand, the deconflicting mechanisms to protect humanitarian aid delivery in relation to military operations are not effective. And so my sincere hope is that the negotiations for the release of hostages and some form of cessation of hostilities to be successful, to avoid a all-out offensive over Rafah, where the core of the humanitarian system is located, and that would have devastating consequences. Thank you very much.
General, two more journalists were targeted.
The UN Secretary General speaking there. Dr. Khafer, as we know, the UN chief and the Israeli Prime Minister have a fractious relationship, with Tel Aviv succeeding to a degree in sidelining the global body altogether. How does the aid agency get around this? People are dying all around as we speak.
As a matter of fact, it is something about like can be described just really horrific. I mean, what we get from the ground, just I was talking to some colleagues earlier, which they have some connection to Gaza, especially to the humanitarian aids. They are really giving a very terrifying picture, because the situation on the ground, especially when it comes to the food, to the medical basic needs, is just very, very restricted, and the people hardly getting really what they can eat on daily basis. Many of the people, they can't really get any kind of food portions on daily basis. So sometimes they eat one day, they might not find food for the next day. The organizations just trying their best to, you know, just to really work around these kind of restrictions, and it seems to be the Israeli government is really just pushing all their plans forward in order to starve the people and just to put more or to mount more pressure on the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, because it seems to be this is the only way probably to achieve some compromises from the Palestinian resistance in the negotiations. So situation is becoming, you know, very difficult, and it seems to be the Israel is just really challenging all the world, no exception, whether the United Nations, whether the European countries. We have heard yesterday what Borrell was saying. He was clearly devastated. Yeah, there is no attention whatsoever to any call, any announcement, any condemnation from the international community. So Israel is just really positioning itself to be above anyone, above everyone, above any kind of action.
There's some movements in some quarters in Europe, of course. You mentioned Europe there, Amar, and that's what I want to talk to you about. We know Israel is blocking aid in contravention of the ICJ ruling. As I said at the beginning of the show, at the top, that there have been rockets fired into northern Zionist entity, killing one soldier, injuring a number of others. And at the same time, the independent bloc members of the European parliamentarians are pushing for the full pariah treatment for Israel, including being banned from international events. We've seen it done to South Africa in the last century and to Russia in recent years. What do you make of that route?
Well, look, I think the EU, we have to be very careful, because it's not a homogenous bloc. We talk about the European Union, but there are different powers vying for authority in there. You have Germany, which is obviously very fanatically pro-Israel. But then you have other member states like Spain, Ireland, France to a lesser degree, who have either opposed Israel right from the very beginning or have taken or sort of grown impatient with the scale of the offensive.
And the French have slapped sanctions on some of the settlers too recently.
100%. And actually the United Kingdom is also planning to do something similar. So, you know, but I think clearly the mood is turning. We saw the EU foreign policy chief, which we just mentioned, Josep Borrell, who has said some pretty wild things. In general, is quite a, in my view, quite a pro-colonial man, quite a racist person. Now coming out and saying these really incredible statements about Israel, and saying that if you want to stop Israel committing its offensive, then you have to stop supplying them with arms. So I think that there is a mood turning, not just among sort of, you know, independent parliamentarians, but actually across some very senior levels of member states of the European Union. And so I think we could get to a position, particularly if Israel did launch a full-scale attack on Rafah, and it really, really got out of hand, much more than it already has, where, you know, we could
is
get
that
to
really what it takes, and not 30,000 Palestinians already killed?
Well,
does
I mean,
it have to really be that red line to be crossed by the Israeli regime for these countries to finally come out and say enough is enough?
Well, I mean, it's clear that there's a huge contradiction between how people's lives are viewed. We saw with Ukraine, a white European country, when that was, when Russia launched its operation against Ukraine, there were sanctions slapped on Russia straight away. It was made into an international pariah state, a huge increase in Russophobia even, yeah, among ordinary Russians in Europe. But when Israel does this, it doesn't, you know, we don't get the same treatment. But I do think that if it gets to an even more serious point, that I think is probably what it will have to take, unfortunately, in Europe for the mood to change substantially.
Okay. Now, Dr. Khanfer, do you think also that on the question of what might make Israel think twice about launching that massive incursion into Rafah, the rockets that have been fired into northern Israel from southern Lebanon, although Hezbollah, the resistance movement, the group in Lebanon, has not claimed responsibility, but there have been rockets fired, one Israeli soldier killed, a number of them injured. Do you think that is why a message from the Lebanese to the Israelis, look, if you go ahead with this, then we're going to hurt you?
Yeah, I think this was very obvious from the speech delivered by Hezbollah leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. He actually made a very clear connection between the escalation in Gaza and what's happening in North Lebanon, so in South Lebanon. So by the end of the day, it seems to be the message is very clear, and I don't think we can really raise too many questions about it, whether it is connected or not connected. It seems to be very much connected, and the Hebrew newspapers today, I was looking into some of them published in Hebrew. They were very much talking about the speech delivered by Hassan Nasrallah yesterday, and they gave it really a very, very high level of a credit and a credibility that if the situation in Gaza is gonna to be solved sometime soon, then we would expect a ceasefire also in Lebanon or from the Lebanese side. So yes, the connection is there, and I don't think the Hezbollah is playing games here, because in the previous truce, this is exactly what happened. It was for almost 1 week, and the truce started in Lebanon or from Lebanese
Correct.
Side.
Correct.
So so the kind of a pressure we can imagine is there, and I think it might be escalating as far as the Israelis are escalating their military operations in Gaza.
It's all a matter of time, of course. Just a quick reminder before we move on, this is Gaza Under Attack, a deep dive into the news surrounding the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza's captive population. Well, the disconnect between the British public and politicians who continue their unequivocal support for the U.S.-Israeli genocide of Gazans is even more pronounced. Voters, according to pro-Palestinian activist Naile, are now extremely cautious about how they will be using their votes in the general elections later this year. Naile went on to say that politicians have their own agenda that usually have very little to do with the most vulnerable.
I think they seem to have their own agenda. I think there's a lot of lobbying by the Israelis. I think a lot of people are in the pocket of the Israelis. I think both Labour, I know that a lot of Labour front benches have all taken money from the Israeli lobbyists, and I suspect the same is true for the Conservatives as well. I think it's very, very questionable, and I think it's extraordinary given the amount of these protests that so little notice is shown, and maybe they just feel that come election day this will be a side issue, but I think it's gone so far beyond that for many people. Well, I'm a previous Labour voter and Labour member, and I am not voting for the Labour Party under Keir Starmer. I will vote. I'm in Brighton, so I've got a very potentially strong Green candidate. They've called for a ceasefire, and they are not in the pockets of any lobbyists. I've been to Israel over the last 30 years, so I've seen the horrors that have been there. This, of course, is unprecedented. And I do think it has changed. I think it's made people very disassociated from politicians.
Fear and panic grip Palestinians sheltering in Rafah as hostilities expand in the densely packed area, supposed to provide a safe refuge for over 1.5 million people. The World Health Organization says there truly is nowhere safe in Gaza. People are already living in unimaginable conditions. According to the WHO, a new wave of displacement and additional injuries will have a catastrophic impact on people's health and mental well-being and increase the trauma burden on the already ailing health system, pushing it closer to the brink of collapse. Let's listen to one displaced Gazan.
Last night was really terrible. We lived in terror as if it was doomsday. There was gunfire in every direction and we had nowhere to go. They told us this area was safe. They told us Rafah was safe. The bombardment was in every direction, not knowing where to turn or where to go. We felt like we were going to die.
Well, let's continue the conversation with my guests. I'm Mark Hazmi and Dr. Nahat Khanfer as we enter the final moments of the show. Amar, as we heard the activist there who talked to us in a recent protest, pro-Palestine protest, that a lot of the politicians are in the pockets of the Israel lobby and Zionists, there are already signs that there are some politicians who will pay with their political futures for their stance they've taken on Palestine. Azhar Ali is one of them in Rochdale, Manchester, triggering a by-election. Now others vying for that position. What do you make of that comment and also your own experience with it all?
Well, yes, I mean, I was a member of the Labour Party for 6 years. I was involved in many campaigns on a parliamentary level. I worked in Parliament for a Labour MP. And so, ultimately I felt compelled to leave the Labour Party much earlier than many people are sort of now doing back in May 2021, because it became clear to me that really Keir Starmer had ceded all political sovereignty when it came to the issue of Palestine, Israel, anti-Semitism, Zionism, to the Israel embassy here in Britain. And so I thought that the Labour Party had been totally captured. And really, on this issue, there was never going to be any budging. However, that political trajectory, that very strong pro-Israel political trajectory, yeah, I think is now going backwards. Yeah. We're seeing now people waking up to the horrors of Zionism, not just of this particular current Israeli government, but actually of the Zionist project, realizing that the charge of anti-Semitism is a very cheap one, and weaponized, of course. And the Muslim community in Britain, which has for such a long time supported the Labour Party, you know, my parents' generation and grandparents, many of them supported the Labour Party, have now been shaken out of that to such a large degree. If they weren't before, they've seen now that Keir Starmer's support for the genocide in Gaza is utterly untenable. And so because Muslims across Britain are a huge political constituency, they really have the power to turn the tide at the next general election. And so I think we could see 100% many politicians, not just in the Labour Party, but in the Conservative Party, who've supported this genocide being unseated or being targeted.
There's a level of awareness now among the public unlike any other time. Well, we're fresh out of time, gentlemen. Thank you, Amar Kazmi and Dr. Nahat Khanfer, for coming on. And thank you for spending time with us on Gaza Under Attack. Join us again tomorrow for more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Human rights groups have warned that the Zionist regime's stated plan to forcibly transfer more than 1.4 million Palestinians in Rafah amounts to a continuing Nakba and a genocidal act. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Israel's stated plan to forcibly transfer more than 1.4 million Palestinians in Rafah amounts to a continuing Nakba and a genocidal act, three human rights groups said recently, urging immediate international intervention. Rafah, located in southern Gaza along the border with Egypt, endured some of the deadliest hours of the Zionist regime's military offensive, now in its fifth month. In the early hours of Monday, February 12th, more than 28,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been martyred since October 7th, with thousands more missing under the rubble. An untold number of Palestinians have been martyred from hunger and disease in a secondary wave of mortality resulting from the Zionist regime's military offensive and siege. The vast majority of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people have been displaced, many of them repeatedly, and most are now sheltering in Rafah in inhumane conditions. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's prime minister, has repeatedly threatened to expand the military offensive in Rafah in recent days, raising international alarm over the unprecedented bloodshed and mass expulsion that would all but surely entail. At least 68 Palestinians, including 19 children and 13 women, were martyred during some 2 hours of bombing early on Monday, February 12th, according to Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. The Palestinian Authority's official television station said that 74 people were martyred in Rafah strikes, and that is according to Reuters. The rights group added among those killed were numerous internally displaced persons who had sought shelter in Rafah, many of whom were killed while asleep in their makeshift tents, adding, many more bodies are still under the rubble. The Zionist regime's warplanes targeted at least 15 residential buildings, 2 mosques, agricultural lands, and areas close to the Egyptian-Palestinian border, according to rights groups. The rights group added, helicopters and gunboats were also involved in the attacks. 90 Palestinians, including 34 children, 18 women, and a journalist, were martyred in the Zionist regime's airstrikes on Rafah in the first 10 days of February. Sinai for Human Rights, an organization based in Egypt, said that on early Monday, February 12th, the Zionist regime bombed areas along the Gaza-Egypt border fence, which Cairo has reinforced due to fears of a mass expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza. The three Palestinian human rights groups said that the people amassed on Gaza's border with Egypt had fled to the area at the command of Israeli military on the instruction that Rafah was a designated safe zone. The groups added that the intensified targeting of Rafah comes as the Zionist regime's military continues to empty out Gaza City and forcibly displaces residents southward toward Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis, forcing Palestinians south to Rafah and then announcing the displacement of people in that area, whether internally into smaller pockets of Gaza into Egypt with no basic necessities for survival, is further evidence of the Zionist regime's genocidal intent. An unnamed senior Israeli regime military official told Axios that it had pounded Rafah early on Monday, February 12th, as a diversion while its forces freed two Israeli-Argentine men held in Gaza after being captured during the October 7th events. Of the more than 240 Israelis and foreign nationals who were captured on October 7th, around 130 remain in Gaza after around 100 were freed in a prisoner exchange during a week-long truce in late November. Recently, the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of resistance movement Hamas, announced that two captives were killed and eight were seriously injured in the Zionist regime's strikes during the preceding days. The Zionist regime's military said 31 of the remaining captives in Gaza had been declared dead and their families notified. While international pressure for a ceasefire builds, Netanyahu has vowed to press on, telling an American television program that enough of the remaining captives in Gaza were alive to justify continuing the military operation. Last week, Netanyahu rejected a proposal for a prisoner exchange and an extended pause in fighting put forward by the resistance group Hamas. Reuters reported recently that senior officials from the United States, Egypt, the Zionist regime, and Qatar are due to resume negotiations in Cairo. Sources told Reuters that they are seeking a three-phase deal framework that will see the release of hostages and achieve an extended pause. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterated to Netanyahu over the phone that Washington opposes a military operation in Rafah in the absence of a real plan to protect civilians sheltering there. The airstrikes that killed dozens of civilians in Rafah came just hours after that phone call. Recently, Biden told reporters following talks with Jordan's King Abdullah that Washington was working to secure a deal that would hold hostilities for at least 6 weeks. Asked what kind of leverage the U.S. was applying on the Zionist regime, the U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said recently that diplomatic levers had been used and we have engaged with the Israelis on a multitude of levels. Miller added that those efforts had caused the Zionist regime to take steps at urging that have had real, tangible impact, but they have not been enough. He claimed, when the United States of America stands up and says something publicly, it matters.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today. This year, Iran is marking the 45th anniversary of the victory of the glorious Islamic Revolution. Now, this great revolution inspired many across the world, especially the people of Africa, who have for centuries suffered from exploitation by Western imperialist powers. Iran's Islamic Revolution influenced liberation movements in Africa, particularly South Africa's anti-apartheid movement, which ousted the white minority rule in this country. It is this Free South Africa that filed a complaint at the International Court of Justice against the Israeli apartheid regime over its genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, the 45th anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution is being marked this year amid moves by several African countries to follow Iran's footsteps in resisting Western imperialist powers. Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger are some of the countries that have categorically rejected French imperialism as they seek true independence. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic of Iran has pursued mutually beneficial ties with African countries. Iran seeks to collaborate with African countries in various sectors, including trade, economic affairs, transfer of technology, and culture. The successful visit by Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi to three African countries last year is testimony to the ever-expanding ties between Iran and Africa.
Impact of Islamic Revolution on Africa.
And now to discuss some aspects of the impact of Iran's Islamic Revolution on African countries, we are joined here in the studio by Mohammad Nuruddin, a PhD student on international affairs at Tehran University. Thank you for your time, Mr. Nuruddin.
Thank you so much, Musa Mubarak, for inviting me.
Okay, now, can you first tell us about your acquaintance with the Islamic Revolution? How did you come to know about Iran's Islamic Revolution?
Yeah, initially in Nigeria, it is part of the school's curriculum. So when we were in schools, especially high school, so there's a particular topic which is more on Islamic movement.
Yeah.
So my first experience with Islamic Revolution or Iranian Islamic Revolution, it was there. We were taught in the school, and from there, then in university, there's a particular course called Islamic Political Thought.
Yeah.
So there also we learn about Islamic Revolution.
Oh, very impressive indeed that it's in Nigeria's education system.
Yeah.
Now, as a young Muslim, I mean, how did the Islamic Revolution or the thoughts of the Islamic Revolution impact on your life?
Yeah, Islamic Revolution impacted on my life in different ways, especially the kind of dedication.
Yeah.
Iranian students show during the early days of revolution.
Yeah.
You know, they are a part of people that demonstrated, and even after the revolution, the issue of hostage, which Imam call it a bigger revolution or second revolution, it was carried out by student, young student like me. Iranian revolution or Islamic revolution, it was founded based on supporting the oppressed. We can see that in the issues of Palestine, and not even Palestine, even those who are not Muslim, Iranian revolution has rendered enormous support, issues of apartheid in South Africa, the issues of liberation movement in Southern America, by countries like Nicaragua, and even now Iran is like in front of supporting Venezuela.
Now, as a PhD student right now in Tehran, you have had, you know, that experience, that first-hand experience of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, Iran has achieved numerous revolutions right from the early days of revolution from 1979. Till today. But my first experience with Iranian revolution is concerning the leadership. When I came here I was opportune to visit the house of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, person of Sayyid Ali Khamenei,
in
the early days that we came here. That time correspond with the time Sayyid used to meet with Iranian students. So we were carried out by our university as international student to his house. So the first thing that I noticed is that the leadership of Iran is quite different from the leadership that we used to see in our country, especially with regard to the lifestyle, you know, here.
Simplicity,
you know.
And now let's move forward. Currently, we have seen South Africa has taken the Israeli regime to the International Court of Justice over its genocidal crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, how did the Islamic Revolution impact on South Africa and the liberation movement of South Africa? And so that even now we can see that South Africa is at the forefront of fighting for Palestinians, just like Imam Khomeini did.
You know, before the revolution, the relation between South Africa and Iran, it was just a diplomatic relation. But after the revolution, Imam himself, the court diplomatic relation with the apartheid regime. And after the apartheid regime, you know, Nelson Mandela, who was the pioneer of ANC, he came here and he said that the liberation of South Africa, it was inspired by the Iranian revolution. He came here and he appreciated the effort of Iran in supporting Iranian liberation of South Africa. And after that, you know, he was honored by the University of Tehran, where they gave him a PhD in political science, honorary PhD. So even there, he reiterated that his struggle movement against the apartheid regime was fully inspired by Iran. And in relation to the issues of Palestine, he made it clear after the independence in 1994, he said that the independence of South Africa is incomplete without the independence or freedom of Palestine. That he makes it clear that South Africa or the regime, the current regime in South Africa, it is one of their cardinal objectives to support any country that is having racial discrimination or something related to their freedom. So I think taking Israel to
the ICJ
court, International Court of Justice, is part of the goal of goal and objective of South African government. And as Nelson Mandela said, it was inspired by the Iranian revolution.
Now, still on the issue of Palestine in Africa, we have seen that many Africans have come out to demonstrate, to participate in protests. They are part of the boycott movement against the Israeli regime. So is there any link between, I mean, these activism in Africa and the Islamic Revolution?
Yeah, as I told you before, Africa, we have suffered a lot of issues of slave trade, colonialism, and even now we have the some legacies like the issue of new colonialism. So whenever we had the issue of liberation of people, that they are having issues with their freedom, so we always feel as if it is us because we share the same problem.
And now, Mr. Nureddin, we know that the late Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul, was at the forefront of, you know, stressing about Muslim unity, calling on Muslims across the world to unite. And right now, we know that because of the issue of Palestine, we need unity more than ever before. Now, how is this issue in Nigeria? I mean, considering that Nigeria is a Muslim country, how did the call of unity by Imam Khomeini impact on the Muslims of Nigeria?
Even recently there's a conference that was held here in Tehran.
Yeah.
And so many Sunni scholars.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you may heard about Sheikh Gumi, who happened to be the Grand Qadi of Nigeria during his time.
Mm-hmm.
So his son, who is like his successor now, he was invited here. Mm-hmm. And he attended that international Congress of Ulama, which comprised both Sunni, Shia, and those who are not even aligned to.
Yeah.
So he came here and he appreciated the effort of Iran, and he even went back to Nigeria.
Mm.
So now this, like, he's telling people what he saw here and the effort that Iran is making in the liberation of Palestine, the support they gave them. He was like shocked before. He don't know that there is that effort, but he came here. Now he's like, I have seen so many of his lectures right from the time he came till now. He has been telling people in Nigeria. And apart from that, you know, in the every year there is an issue of Unity Week in the month of Ramadan. So there, under the leadership of Sheikh Zaki, Islamic movement, they used to organize Unity Week, and they invited scholars from Sunni, and they participated and they discussed. And this used to, like, it's a form of proximity and closeness between Muslims.
Okay, thank you for that, Mr. Nureddin. We now take a short break before we continue our topic on how the Islamic Revolution of Iran has impacted on Africa. Stay with us.
Impact of Islamic Revolution on Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. And our guest today is Mr. Muhammad Nureddin. He's a PhD student on international affairs at Tehran University. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Nureddin.
Thank you.
Now, let's move to issues of trade between Iran and Africa. Iran has opened several trade centers in Africa, aiming to develop trade ties between the two sides. Now, what steps do you think should be taken to boost trade between these two sides, Iran and Africa, so that it can be mutually beneficial for the people of the two sides?
Yeah, as you said, in recent years, Iran, especially with the coming of President Ibrahim Raisi, so Iran, like, they are trying to strengthen their trade relationship with Africa.
Yeah.
So there are various steps, I think, apart in the form of in the part of the government, like, they are trying their best. But with regard to the private sectors, like Iranian businessmen, I think still, like, they don't think there is that opportunity in Africa.
Yeah.
So I think there is a need for private sectors in Iran to invest more on Africa.
Now, we know over the last 45 years, Iran has made tremendous progress in terms of technology. And it's been trying to share its technology with African countries. As we know right now, Iran has opened a house of innovation and technology in Kenya, where knowledge-based companies from Iran are, you know, trying to sell their products and services to African countries through Nairobi. So what needs to be done for young people in Africa to get more acquainted with these technological achievements of Iran, particularly considering the fact that Africa has one of the youngest populations in the world, and this is a tech-savvy, you know, population?
Yeah, you know, as you said, after the revolution, Iran has achieved tremendous progress in part of science and technology.
Yeah,
yeah, most of our people, they are aware of that, but, you know, still there is, the process of, like, Iran is providing scholarship for students, and though we are behind some countries, but still we are trying. Mm-hmm. Some of our young people, they came here and they study in the fields of science and technology. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, there is a need of, like, organizing exhibition.
Yeah.
Though there is, but it's not that well known to our people.
Yeah.
So here they need to, like, advertise it, make it like famous for our people to participate and benefit from this tremendous achievement in the areas of science and technology that the Islamic Republic have in now.
Mm-hmm. And we know right now many African countries are trying to do a value addition to their raw materials so that they can improve their economies and stop relying on the West, especially in terms of minerals. They have minerals like coltan, you know, which are very critical in today's world. And we know that Iran has attained self-sufficiency in its industries here, courtesy of the Islamic Revolution, because after the Islamic Revolution, there were a lot of effort to ensure that the industries here don't rely on the West. And actually, because of sanctions, they have become now self-reliant. So how can African countries, you know, learn from Iran in terms of being self-reliant and do value addition for their own minerals and natural resources?
Yeah, you know, there is a theory of dependency that's like they propose the issue of delinking.
Yeah.
Though delinking in this world is somehow difficult, but at least we need to reduce our dependence on Western countries for us to added value to our own resources. As you said, before the revolution, we know the situation that Iran used to be. You know, even part of the reasons of revolution is related to the 1953 coup, which was happened to be like a process of like having control of your own resources. We know that in that time, Iranian oil, it was being fully controlled by British Petroleum, BP. But the regime or the government in that time of Mohammed Mossadegh tried to liberate or even ask them to pay for the royalty of using Iranian field, but they refused to, which later on lead to the nationalization of Iranian petroleum that trigger the coup in that time. We know that is part of the... So African countries, they need to, like, learn from Iran.
Yeah.
They have to be self-sufficient and independent.
You know, educational exchanges are actually very critical, you know, in exchanging know-how. And being a PhD student here in Iran, can you tell us your opinion on Iran's education standards and how African countries can benefit or have exchanges with Iran in this regard in terms of academic issues?
The standard of education here, especially, you know, university education, most of the universities here, they are ranked higher in the international university ranking. For instance, universities like University of Tehran, Amir Kabir University, most of them, they rank between 200 and 300 best university in the world. It's ranked the first country in terms of publication among the Muslim world. So I think it is a good idea for our people. As I told you before, we were invited several times by the Iranian Ministry of Education for the issue of attracting foreign students. So Iran is open for our students to come here to benefit from this educational deployment that is here. Yeah, it is good.
Yeah, and Mr. Nureddin, we know that Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi last year, 2023, visited three African countries, Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. How important was this trip to these countries and actually to Africa or for Africa in general?
Yeah, as you said, he traveled to three countries of Kenya, Uganda, and
Zimbabwe.
So, as you know, Kenya is one of the developed countries in Eastern Africa and in Africa in general, and it has access to seas and ocean. So, they are also trying to, like, have a transportation link to Europe via Iran. So, that visit of President Ibrahim Raisi, I think it's a good idea for that country to, like, have or advance their own businesses with Iranians, and also Kenyans also will benefit from the, that business. And in Uganda, I learned that President Raisi also start extraterritorial cultivation. They call it Iran Farm. So because the land there is fertile, and maybe some of the farm produce that they have there is either expensive here or the land here is not fertile enough to. So this is also a good opportunity that Iranians will benefit, and also Ugandans will benefit, because it will provide like employment opportunities for the youth there. And I think even also some industries will be established out of that farm that they started now. This is the beginning. We don't know what will happen in the future. And apart from that, Zimbabwe happened to be like a progressive and active member of non-aligning movement. And Iran also is part of that. And I could remember I read that the first and only travel of Ayatollah Khamenei to Africa was when he attended the non-alignment movement meeting there that took place in Zimbabwe. So there is that relationship, and I think both countries will benefit for strengthening their relationship.
Now, Mr. Nureddin, you come from Nigeria, an oil and gas-rich country, and now you are living and studying in Iran. And you know, we know that Iran is also an oil and gas-rich country. But Iran is almost self-sufficient in these two sectors, oil and gas sector. And they are relying on local companies and local technical and technological know-how and local expertise. So how do you think Nigeria, which has over decades relied on Western multinationals, which have actually looted its resources, how can Nigeria benefit from Iran's know-how in this energy sector?
I think there is also a plan for this. You know, some years back, Nigerian Minister of Petroleum in person of Silva, he came here and he discussed with Iranian government official concerning the issue of collaborative investment and cooperation in the fields of downstream sector. So this discusses a lot, and I think Nigeria will benefit from Iran, because Iran is not, as you said, doesn't have that exploitative
like approach like,
like Western countries. So Nigeria will benefit a lot from Iran of being self-sufficient.
And now, as you mentioned earlier, over the last few months we have seen an awakening in several West African countries, and in this case I want to mention Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, where the masses are rising up against France, and even now we have governments which are opposed to the French hegemony and imperialism. Do you think this the Islamic Revolution has impacted on the views of the masses in these countries?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
As I told you that before, when you were asking about people's or young people opinion about Iranian revolution, people there, they are watching what is happening in Iran, and they are seeing the progress. Iran is being recorded in part of deployment. So you know, in countries like Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali.
Yeah.
Although it was a coup d'etat, you know, it is the military that overthrew the government, but they were supported by youth with the way they used to rally, demonstrated. I think this could be because of the inspiration of the Iranian revolution.
And now, last question. I think our time is almost running out. The Islamic Republic of Iran is at the forefront of confronting Western cultural onslaught. You know, these Western powers are intent on imposing their evil culture on many countries, and Iran is one of them. And African countries are also not an exception, and they are struggling to, you know, preserve their culture from this onslaught. How can African countries and Iran collaborate in confronting these Western cultural onslaught, which is a threat to the identity, especially of the youth in these countries?
Yeah, thank God that Iran is an Islamic country, and we know that almost over 30 countries in Africa, they have more than 50% of Muslim population. I think in that area, those countries will have to work and cooperate in like cultural cooperation in preserving their own culture. You know, before we know that here, before the revolution, there was issue of modernization, where the regime of that time wanted to like import the culture of West and like impose it in the on the people of Iran. But when the Islamic revolution succeed, Imam Khomeini, like, they tried to put the issue of spirituality in the people and the society, liberated from that cultural imposition of the West. So I think African countries also will benefit by collaborating and cooperating with Iran to learn how they achieve in, like, challenging or fighting that cultural onslaught that they have been, like, imposing on us now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Nureddin, for your time today.
You're welcome, Mr. Mubarak.
Yeah, and viewers, we've been having a chat on how the Islamic Revolution has impacted on Africa, and we were talking with Mr. Mohammed Nureddin, a PhD student on international relations at Tehran University. It's been great having you, and until next time, it's goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, Liberal Democrats say last month an average of 5,735 people a day face waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in accidents and emergency departments in hospitals. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than 1.5 million patients in England had to wait 12 hours or longer in accidents and emergency departments in the past year, according to figures that MPs say lay bare the impact of the government's neglect of the National Health Service. Last month, 177,805 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in emergency departments, an average of 5,735 a day. It means 1 in 10 patients, or 12.4% of patients arriving at accidents and emergency departments, waited 12 hours before being admitted, transferred or discharged. In total, between February of 2023 and January of 2024, 1,540,945 patients experienced long waits, according to analysis of official data by the Liberal Democrats. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments, waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need, according to Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson. Daisy Cooper added, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service." January was the worst month in the past year as winter